Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 224, updating a series on German corporate control over American publishing. We've done programs named or numbered 122, 123, 152, side A, 177, 189, 194, and 218. One of the main companies that we've been talking about in connection with this is Bertelsmann. That firm was basically overseen by Heinrich Mohn, who in World War II established that firm as the number one publisher of books for the Wehrmacht and SS. He himself was a, quote, honorary, unquote, member of the SS, a member of the Himmlerkreis, the Himmler circle of friends, industrialists, and financiers who financed the SS. And as recently as 1993, Dirk Bavendam, the House historian for Bertelsmann, published a book which blamed World War II on U.S. imperialism, Franklin Roosevelt, Jewish control over the American news media, and which basically exonerated Hitler for blame for World War II. Bear in mind that Bertelsmann is the third largest media conglomerate in the world, and it has, along with the also Nazi-affiliated von Holtzbrinck firm, total control over American publishing. We are going to begin with an excerpt from For the Record program number 218. Bear in mind also in connection with Bertelsmann that the available evidence suggests that it is affiliated with the Bormann Group, about which I've spoken so many times, the economic component of the Underground Reich, and also weigh this against the background of the book Serpent's Walk, a Nazi tract published in 1991, which talks about the SS taking over the United States, or their descendants taking over the United States in the mid-21st century, after they had gone underground, built up their economic power, and bought into the American opinion, forming media. This is a lengthy subject, and so I cannot go into any detail in summarizing some of the major points. We're going to begin, as I said, directly with an excerpt from For the Record program number 218, the last update on this subject. This was recorded on April 9th of the year 2000. One of the areas in which Bertelsmann's capital is being targeted for enormous expansion is online book sales, this in keeping with the expansion of German corporate control over American publishing. We're going to look now at the Financial Times of London of Thursday, March 23rd of the year 2000. This is an article by William Hall in Zurich. It's headlined, Bertelsmann lays out BOL.com plans. The article reads in part as follows. BOL.com, the online bookstore of German publishing giant Bertelsmann, is confident that its forthcoming initial public offering will give it the financial muscle to overtake Amazon.com as Europe's biggest internet book retailer. BOL started in Germany in February of 1999 and has operations in 13 countries. Although BOL has not released any revenue figures, Heinz Wermelinger, W-E-R-M-E-L-I-N-G-E-R, BOL's chief executive, claims that his company is number two in Europe after Amazon, the U.S.-backed internet retailer. The IPO will, quote, put us in a position to accelerate the establishment of BOL as number one in international media e-commerce, unquote, says Mr. Wermelinger, a Swiss citizen and former chief executive of AOL Europe. Skipping down, Amazon remains the clear market leader in the U.S., where Bertelsmann's joint venture with Barnes & Noble is number two. However, Mr. Wermelinger says his company will soon overtake Amazon in the rest of the world. It remains to be seen how accurate that particular prediction is, but I would note that BarnesandNoble.com, of course, is 50% owned by Bertelsmann. And if, in fact, this prediction is correct, and if the BOL, Bertelsmann's online book sales, does overtake Amazon and the rest of the world, that will, of course, put Bertelsmann number one in the rest of the world, and BarnesandNoble.com, 50% owned by Bertelsmann number two in the U.S. If, in fact, there's an economic downturn, it remains to be seen if Amazon goes the route of a great many other e-companies and ultimately is available for takeover. Amazon, from what I hear, is one of the healthier of the e-commerce firms, but it certainly remains to be seen what happens. And that was an excerpt of For the Record program number 218, recorded on April 9th of the year 2000. We will indeed see what happens, but we're going to take a look now at something that's happened since that program was recorded. Speaking on April 16th of the year 2000, when this is being recorded, the past week has seen a huge sell-off in the American capital markets. Reading from the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, April 13th of the year 2000, bear in mind that this article reflects that the downturn in the NASDAQ up through Wednesday, and that does not include this past Friday. Article by David Lazarus of the San Francisco Chronicle. This is entitled Investors Dump Technology Stocks. It is subheaded Big Sell-Off Indicates, quote, bubble has popped, unquote. And this is before the record drop of this past Friday, April 14th. Skipping down in this article, we read, and we're going to see commentary here by Arthur Hogan of Jefferies & Company, a market analyst based in Boston. Quote, speaking of investors, Hogan says, they're sick of hearing the same old story from guys like Amazon.com, unquote, he said. Again quoting, investors want to see profits, not just revenue growth, unquote. Shares of Amazon, the Internet's biggest retailer, fell 11% yesterday to close at $56.38. That was an 11% drop in Amazon.com. On Wednesday, it closed at $56.38. After Friday, the closing quote, reading now from the New York Times of Saturday, April 15th of the year 2000, and these stock quotes can be obtained in any newspaper or online, Amazon closed at 46.78. That is down from $56.38, down $9.50, or roughly 16% since Wednesday. So from Wednesday through Friday, Amazon went down roughly, its stock devalued roughly 27%, and that would leave Amazon.com's book sale business perhaps available for purchase by Bertelsmann. So we will indeed see what happens. For the Record program 194, an update, one of the updates on the German corporate control over American publishing, we talked about Bertelsmann's capital policy and how they always got very good, they had made a point of getting very good return on their net capital expenditures. We're going to review that information right now and bear this in mind against the background of what has happened to Amazon and other .com stocks. Again, bearing in mind that Amazon.com's book business might be available for purchase by Bertelsmann if Amazon tanks. The New York Times of Sunday, January 30th of the year 2000, had the following article by Doreen Carvajal, Carvajal, headlined Leading Bertelsmann's Race to the Future. It's about Bertelsmann's CEO, Thomas Middelhoff. And skipping down in the article about Bertelsmann's capital policies, we read, historically, the decisive measure of success or failure for Bertelsmann's companies has been a formula that some of its American executives call the Holy Grail, but in German is rendered Gesamtkapitalrendite, the return on assets or on total capital employed. By the way, that's Gesamtkapitalrendite. Continuing, for almost two decades, the rate has been set at 15%, a value established by Reinhard Mohn, a fourth-generation descendant of the company's founder. And then skipping down, it talks about how this figure has been revised downward, but is still going to remain very formidable. However, the reduction, the modest reduction in net return on capital employed will free up capital for expenditures. Skipping down, we read, the new figure hasn't been established, but relaxing the standard will free yet more money for acquisitions, Mr. Middelhoff said, quote, depending on what dog comes along, unquote. Already, Bertelsmann has budgeted at least 20 billion marks, a little more than $10 billion for deal-making in the next 2 years. And this was before the divestiture of stock in AOL, and also before the initial public offering by BOL.com. I would note that Time Warner was acquired by AOL, including a huge amount of debt that had been incurred by Time Warner. This may imperil AOL at some point in the future. Certainly would make Bertelsmann's ground-level investment in AOL a very, very wise expenditure indeed. The sale of that investment netted Bertelsmann a huge amount of money, a very, very shrewd investment indeed. We're going to take a look now at another Bertelsmann deal that we took a look at in For the Record Program 218, recorded a week ago on April 9th of 2000. This concerns a joint Bertelsmann-Pearson PLC television deal in order to form the largest TV company in Europe, and this company is now eyeing investments in American television broadcasting. This is an article from the Wall Street Journal of Monday, April 10th of the year 2000, dateline London. It's authored by Charles Goldsmith and headlined, Pearson Bertelsmann TV Firm Plans for Its U.S. Dream, unquote, Market. The article reads in part as follows. The new international media concern formed by the merger of the television unit of Britain's Pearson PLC with Bertelsmann AG's broadcasting arm said it will try to expand in the U.S. and will urge relaxation of U.S. laws limiting foreign ownership of television stations. Quote, this new entity is big enough to start businesses in the U.S., unquote, Bertelsmann chairman and chief executive Thomas Middlehoff said, adding that the new company also would seek joint ventures with U.S. broadcasters. Again quoting, the Americans now know that there is one pan-European leader that could be of interest to them, unquote, said the Bertelsmann boss, again skipping down. The new company will be owned 37% by Bertelsmann, 30% by Audiophina parent Group Bruxelles-Lambert, and 22% by Pearson, with 11% publicly held. We noted in For the Record Program 218 that the Audiophina company was a holding company based in Luxembourg, one of the major epicenters of the Bormann Flight Capital Organization, of the Bormann Group, I should say, and that many of the Luxembourg-based Bormann properties were ostensibly held by French and Belgian investors with majority voting rights. A Belgian investor has a 72% stake, voting right, in Audiophina, strongly suggesting Bormann ownership or control of the Audiophina company, which is a partner with Bertelsmann. Now note that this company is now eyeing invasion of the U.S. television market, and note also that they're going to be pushing for relaxation of U.S. rules to limit foreign ownership, to limit foreign ownership of television stations. It'll be interesting to see if George W., whom evidence suggests may very well be affiliated with the Bormann Group, gets in office, and or if the Republican-controlled Congress, if it remains Republican-controlled, will relax those rules and permit Bertelsmann Pearson's venture to increase. Now, note that Pearson and Bertelsmann now have two joint ventures. One is this TV venture, and the other is the Financial Times Deutschland. I have been relying in considerable measure for economic news on the Financial Times of London. It's a very good newspaper. It now has a joint venture with Bertelsmann, and I have noticed that the West Coast version of this, which is published in the Bay Area, has been, shall we say, less rigorous in recent months in its coverage of German economic news, and less critical as well. It's still well worth subscribing to, but I would note that as Pearson and Bertelsmann draw together, as is the case with the drawing together of any two major corporate entities, the policy of the company that Bertelsmann is joining toward is going to be influenced by their partnership with Bertelsmann. This is standard operating procedure in the business world. We should note this. We're going to take a look now at the Financial Times of London's issue of April 8th and April 9th of the year 2000. This is an article by James Harding about the Bertelsmann-Pearson deal. It's entitled Joint Transmission, and skipping down we read, perhaps the ultimate question for many investors is whether this deal means Pearson and Bertelsmann are moving inexorably together. The two companies now work together not only in television, but also on Financial Times Deutschland, a joint venture newspaper in Germany. Mrs. Scardino, parenthetically the head of Pearson, and Mr. Middlehoff, parenthetically the head of Bertelsmann, are keen to Scott's suggestions that the deal could lead to a bigger combination. They say they are open to further cooperation between Pearson and Bertelsmann, but ruled out the possibility of a merger of the two companies. Skipping down, instead, the heads of two of Europe's leading media companies appear content with an informal alliance. Note that there's an informal alliance between two of Europe's leading media companies. We're going to talk more about Pearson in just a second, but bear in mind the Serpent's Walk book, published by Serpent's Walk, book and scenario. Serpent's Walk is a book, ostensibly a novel published by the National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm of the National Alliance, the most important domestic Nazi organization in the United States. The book was authored by Randolph D. Calverhall, C-A-L-V-E-R-H-A-L-L, that's a pen name, and it's about a takeover by what I call the Underground Reich in the mid-21st century. The SS, in this, quote, novel, unquote, goes underground and takes over the United States. As I've said in the past, I believe that this book, like the Turner Diaries, also published by National Vanguard Books, is far more than the novel it purports to be, but rather is a blueprint, a manifesto of what the Underground Reich is doing and intends to do. Now, the SS, their descendants at least, take over the United States after a number of things happen, and this book is set in the mid-21st century. Speaking of the SS and their descendants, this book says on the back cover, "Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media." And of that process, the description is presented as follows in Serpent's Walk, and this is something we've read many times in the past. This is a conversation between a couple of the Nazi faithful named Lessing and Wrench, and Wrench is explaining things to Lessing. Wrench says here in Serpent's Walk, "About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a super corporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, not with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba." One wonders if perhaps Bertelsmann and Pearson are now cuddling up, or whether Pearson or Bertelsmann is now cuddling up to, or whether Bertelsmann is now cuddling up to Pearson like that, quote, great gubbing amoeba, and whether it will begin gently munching it up. It will certainly influence it. It'll be interesting to see if Bertelsmann tries to and succeeds in buying up some of Pearson's publishing arm, our publishing vehicles. I mention this because the one area that, in the United States at least, that was not completely dominated by German publishers was educational publishing. They had a significant inroad. Take note of the following. Now, this is before the Pearson-Bertelsmann TV deal. This is from the New York Times of Monday, April 3rd of the year 2000. This is datelined London, April 2nd, and headlined, "Pearson will buy Dorling Kindersley in $496 million deal." This is from the Bloomberg News, news service. That's a business news service. It reads in part as follows. Pearson PLC, that's the company, of course, it's in the partnership with Bertelsmann, beginning again, Pearson PLC, the world's largest educational publisher, agreed on Friday to buy Dorling Kindersley Holdings for £311 million, or $496 million in cash to gain multimedia titles like the Children's Illustrated Encyclopedia and the Gardner's Handbook 2000. Skipping down, Pearson, which owns Penguin Books, the Financial Times, and a television business, has the money and distribution power needed to build Dorling Kindersley into a more successful business, analysts said. Note Pearson's ownership of Penguin Books. We're going to come back to that. The analyst quoted here, by the way, is Louise Barton, an analyst at Investec Henderson Crawthwaite. She says, quote, of Pearson, "They can add to distribution in a big way using the power of Penguin." So note Pearson's ownership of Penguin Books, and Penguin Books a significant place in the world of English language publishing. And note that Pearson, a company up to which, to coin a phrase, Bertelsmann is gently cuddling like that great gubbing amoeba, Pearson is the largest educational publishing firm in the world, and one of their major arms, one of their major assets, is Penguin Books. Now, we're going to take a look at Penguin Books, which also figured in the news this past week. We're going to read now from the San Francisco Chronicle of Wednesday, April 2nd of the year 2000. This is an article by Marjorie Miller of the Los Angeles Times. It's headlined, "British Holocaust Denier Loses His Libel Suit." And the article is subheaded, "U.S. Professor Said He Distorted Facts and History." This is Dateline London and reads in part as follows. Now note who the co-defendant was here. Britain's High Court called Hitler biographer David Irving, quote, anti-Semitic and racist, unquote, in a scathing ruling yesterday that had rejected the libel charges he had brought over claims he is a Holocaust denier. Irving had sued Deborah Lipstadt, a professor at Atlanta's Emory University, and her British publisher, Penguin UK, for portraying him as someone who falsifies history to suit his widely dismissed views on Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust, including the assertion that there were no gas chambers at Auschwitz. The British historian claimed that Lipstadt's book, Denying the Holocaust, The Growing Assault on Truth and Memory, unquote, distorted the truth and damaged his reputation. Skipping down, the judge ruled, Irving had misrepresented Hitler's views on Jews to try to exonerate the Nazi leader. Quote, he has done so in some instances by misinterpreting and mistranslating documents, and in other instances by omitting documents or parts of them, unquote, Gray said. The result is a picture of Hitler, quote, at odds with the evidence, unquote. While acknowledging that historians make errors, the judge rejected Irving's claim that his mistakes were innocent. Gray said they consistently presented Hitler in, quote, an unwarrantedly favorable light, unquote. And skipping down, the judge also, quote, warned Irving that he would have to, actually this is not a quote, but speaking of Judge Gray, he warned Irving that he would have to pay the bulk of the defense's legal fees, estimated by Penguin at more than $3 million. So note that Penguin Books, one of the major publishing assets of Pearson, Bertelsmann has been cuddling, they were the publisher of Ms. Lipstadt's book. And I would note that the Serpent's Walk scenario involves a control of the media and a revision of history. Reading again from the back cover, speaking of the SS, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media. A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality, unquote. I would note that the House historian, as I said earlier, and as discussed in For the Record segments 177 and 189, the House historian of Bertelsmann, Dirk Bovendam, as recently as 1993, published a book in which he blamed World War II on U.S. imperialism, Franklin D. Roosevelt, Jewish control over the American news media, and basically exonerated Hitler for blame of the war. And the company for whom he was the House historian, or for which he was the House historian, is rapidly gaining control not only of American publishing, but of other American media. And American publishing is accomplished in combination with the von Holtzbrinck firm. I would note that at some point in the future, whether Penguin Books could be influenced by Bertelsmann's cuddling up to Pearson, its parent company, or whether eventually Bertelsmann winds up buying Penguin from Pearson. That would not entail a merger between the two companies, but merely the acquisition of one element of Pearson, or a merger. That ultimately could lead to the revision of history. They wouldn't have to sue Penguin Books. They could simply block the publication of books or the reprinting of books like Ms. Lipstadt's, and that is not something that should be too readily dismissed. Holocaust denial, as well as other aspects of historical revisionism, are now rapidly gaining steam. Reading now from the New York Times of Thursday, April 13th of the year 2000. This is an AP story, Dateline Shiraz, Iran, April 12th, and headlined, No Open Trial for Jews in Spying Case, Iran Says. And skipping down, we read, Also today, the Tehran Times sought to deny the Holocaust and praised the views of the British writer David Irving. Mr. Irving, who has said the Holocaust death toll was greatly exaggerated, lost a libel suit on Tuesday against an American scholar who had criticized his work and her publisher. Quoting from the Tehran Times, One of the biggest frauds of the outgoing century, which dragged into the new millennium, was the story of the Holocaust made up by the Zionists to blackmail the West, unquote, the Tehran Times, an English-language newspaper, said. The Tehran Times has now become the second major official organ of a Middle Eastern country to deny the Holocaust. In For the Record program number 197, Historical Revisionism, we took a look at Holocaust denial, and I'm going to review a section of an op-ed column from the New York Times about Syria's denial of the Holocaust, this in the Tishrin state newspaper of Syria. This is an op-ed column from the New York Times of Tuesday, February 8th of the year 2000. This is a foreign affairs op-ed column by Thomas Friedman. It's headlined, Liar's Poker, Intercontinental Style. And it reads in part as follows. The big lie had a big week last week. In Austria, Jörg Haider, who has expressed sympathy for Hitler's full employment policies, defended the Waffen-SS and referred to Nazi concentration camps as punishment camps, unquote, saw his extremist Freedom Party sworn into power after a strong finish in recent elections. And in Syria, the leading state newspaper, Tishrin, published an editorial that asked, quote, why does Israel insist on bringing up this alleged Holocaust policy, unquote? It's just to get, again quoting, it's just to get money and to reinforce the myth of the Holocaust in the face of credible voices questioning it, including that of the controversial British historian David Irving, unquote. So both the Tishrin paper and the Tehran Times reference David Irving in becoming the first nations to officially deny the Holocaust, and that I think is well worth taking into account. I would note that Holocaust denial has its roots firmly in the Third Reich, not just the Holocaust itself, but also Holocaust denial. We're going to turn now to the book Dreamer of the Day, subtitled Francis Parker Yockey and the Postwar Fascist International, authored by the brilliant Kevin Coogan, C-O-O-G-A-N, published in softcover by Otano Media, copyright 1999. And of the group of Nazis around Dr. Werner Naumann, a former Goebbels propaganda ministry official and SS officer, and a key operative of what I call the Underground Reich, we read as follows about some of the associates of Werner Naumann, named Dr. Karl Heinrich Peter and Dr. Heinrich Maltz, and their role in helping to generate Holocaust denial. Kevin Coogan writes, Maltz and Peter were important behind-the-scenes figures in the Holocaust denial movement. According to the October-November 1954 issue of the ADL journal Facts, Peter and Maltz wrote a preliminary memorandum on Holocaust denial called The Big Swindle of the 6 Million, unquote. And of connections between the Naumann Circle and elements in the Middle East, we'll recall that Iran and Syria have now become two of the first countries to more or less officially deny the Holocaust, we read as follows in Dreamer of the Day. The British particularly feared the Naumann Circle's astonishing influence in the Middle East. According to a March 1953 report by the non-sectarian Anti-Nazi League, Dr. Gustav Scheel, S-C-H-E-E-L, a Bruderschaft leader arrested with Naumann, maintained excellent ties to the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. German corporations wishing to do business in the Middle East and Africa first had to approach Naumann, Scheel, SS and Odessa leader Skorzeny, and the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem. The Grand Mufti, by the way, I would add parenthetically, the first leader of the Palestinian National Movement, was an officer in the SS and a key Nazi spy, as we looked at in, among other programs, for Radio Free America 22. Continuing. Gustav Scheel was especially close to Iran's nationalist leader, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh, and supported Iranian efforts to nationalize Western oil companies. So note the use by the Underground Reich of anti-imperialist forces opposed to the United States and Great Britain. I would also note, ironically, that Mossadegh was ultimately succeeded by Fazola Zahedi after he was overthrown in a CIA coup. Zahedi had worked for the Third Reich as a spy against Britain in that part of the world, as we looked at in Radio Free America program number 3. So as one watches Bertelsmann and other firms gaining control of American publishing, bear in mind the scenario of Serpent's Walk and the revision of history that is needed to, quote, change the hearts and minds of white Americans prior to the Underground Reich taking over. That concludes this program. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.